Okay, so I apologize for the technical difficulties before. It's particularly embarrassing being a professor at an Institute of Technology, and I thank Sean Carroll and Lisa Randall, two professors of liberal arts, for helping me get back online. And in fact, this is my computer working now, even though it didn't work a few hours ago. I'm going to give an overview today of several problems in cosmology. So we know several things about the universe beyond the fact that it's expanding and that the expansion seems to be accelerating. There are a number of questions in cosmology that may require new physics in order to solve. So the problems I'll talk about are dark matter and galaxies and cluster halos, negative pressure, dark energy. The physics of inflation is something that we would like to understand better. There are also other possibilities or observations that may suggest new physics, and two of them that I'll talk about are galactic substructure and suppression of large-scale power. There are other things like ultra-high-energy cosmic rays and maybe a running of a spectral index that may or may not be indicating new physics, maybe variations in the fine structure constant, but I won't discuss those. So before I talk about the unsolved problems, let me remind you of some of the things that we have discovered over the past 5 years. So it's never a good idea to drive by looking only in the rearview mirror. But it is kind of interesting that over the past 5 years, we really had a period of spectacular progress in cosmology. Whether this continues into the future or not remains to be determined, but there is considerable momentum with us right now. So just 5 years ago, if I look at AstroPH, it was clear that we did not know whether the universe was open, closed, or flat. Now we do. People no longer write papers on open universes with an omega matter of 0.3 and no cosmological constant or anything else. 5 years ago, there were a lot of papers appearing on AstroPH on topological defect theories for structure formation. We no longer see those. 5 years ago, there was some evidence from supernovae that there was a cosmological constant, but it was controversial. It wasn't clear whether the supernova data could be trusted. Now we have evidence completely from a completely different avenue, the CMB, that seems to confirm what the supernovae were telling us. People used to talk about primordial isocurvature perturbations. They no longer do, unless it's only a small addition to the dominant adiabatic perturbations. 5 years ago, we had some evidence indication that baryon density was consistent with Big Bang nucleosynthesis from deuterium abundances. Again, the CMB have provided a completely independent confirmation that the baryon density is in agreement with that predicted by Big Bang nucleosynthesis. 5 years ago, it wasn't clear whether we could measure cosmological parameters with a cosmic microwave background. Now it's clear that we can. 5 years ago, people were still wondering whether mega-galaxy surveys like the Sloan and 2DF would actually work. They do. We now have these mega-galaxy surveys. We're learning a tremendous amount from them. 5 years ago, people were wondering whether you could actually ever detect the large-scale or measure the large-scale distribution of mass with weak gravitational lensing. Now we can do it. There are a number of groups that are doing it almost routinely. 5 years ago, we had not yet detected the CMB polarization. Now we have, first by DAISY about a year ago, and then earlier this year from MAP. Self-interacting dark matter, I think this was a little bit less than 5 years ago. There were some questions around 5 years, maybe a little less ago, that the dark matter could be self-interacting. And now it seems through a variety of observations that we did not really know about at the time that it's not going to be likely. Also, in the past 5 years, we've seen a number of space astrophysics missions launched successfully. I think Chandra and XMM were actually launched a little more than 5 years ago, but the first science results certainly came out within the past 5 years. MAP was launched, and over the past year, GALAX and CERTIF have been launched, and there are a number of other very exciting astrophysics missions being in the queue. And you should know about this as American or European taxpayers. This is your money, your tax dollars at work. So, a frivolous slide, and on to the science. So the first thing I'll talk about is dark matter. So I'm actually surprised that the dark matter does not receive more attention now I'm surprised that it does not receive as much attention as it should. One of the most long-standing questions in cosmology from the time of Fritz Zwicky over close to 70 years ago is the nature of dark matter. So there is very strong evidence for dark matter in galaxy and galactic halos, and the evidence comes from galactic rotation curves. It does not really rely on the CMB or large-scale structure, any of the other recent developments. We've known about this for years. Vera Rubin and others measured these rotation curves and realized that they implied the existence of dark matter, say 30 or so years ago. So from the observed rotation curves, we know that there must be a galactic halo in our galaxy, a dark matter halo, with a local density of about half a proton mass per cc. And we know that whatever particles or objects make up the dark matter move in our galaxy with a velocity of roughly 300 kilometers per second. Okay. Now, I think that one of the reasons, well, we also know that that this stuff is probably not baryons, or almost certainly not baryons. From the CMB and also from light element abundances, we know that the baryon density is 0.05. On the other hand, we know that the matter density from dynamics, CMB, structure formation, classical cosmological tests, etc., is about 0.3. 0.3 is much bigger than 0.05, even if I use very conservative error bars. And so, and also we know from galaxy clusters that the matter density in the clusters is much bigger than the baryon density in clusters. And therefore, whatever this dark matter is, it's not baryons. So I think that one of the reasons that it has not received more theoretical attention recently is that there is such a good idea for what this stuff could be, such a front runner, that it's no fun being a theorist because you can't come up with lots of ideas that may or may not be controversial. The front runner, I believe, is a weakly interacting massive particle. So simply stated, if you believe that there is new physics beyond the standard model at the electroweak scale, and that new physics introduces the existence of a new stable, massive, weakly interacting massive particle, that particle would be the dark matter in the universe today. That would have a cosmological abundance very close to unity. You would not have to invent any mechanism to produce these particles in the early universe. You would not have to invent any other particle. You would not have to change the interactions beyond those that you generally assume you would have with a particle with new weak interactions. So the classic example of this is the neutralino, the supersymmetric partner of the photon, gauge bosons, and Higgs bosons. Another very intriguing possibility is the axion. Again, as far as I know, the Petri-Quinn solution is still the most attractive solution to the strong CP problem, and the only available axion mass, the axion mass window now is somewhere around 10 to the minus 3 to 6 electron volts. And again, if the axion exists with that mass, it naturally has a cosmological density close to unity and therefore would be the dark matter in galactic halos. So this is an interesting question not only for theorists, but perhaps more so for experimentalists. Because if the dark matter is a WIMP, one can show that the annihilation cross-section that fixes the cosmological density to be of order unity is roughly 3 times 10 to the minus 27 centimeter cubed per second. And by a crossing symmetry, if the annihilation cross-section to ordinary matter is roughly this strength, then the particle will also have some coupling to ordinary matter for elastic scattering. And therefore, these particles can be detected in direct detection experiments. Or perhaps indirectly, they can be accumulated in the sun or the earth and annihilate and produce high-energy neutrinos that can be detected by experiments like MACRO or Ice Cube or Kamiokande or Super Kamiokande, Baksan, several other experiments. Or they might annihilate the galactic halo and produce anomalous cosmic rays like strange cosmic ray positron spectra or antiproton spectra or gamma rays. So anyway, there are ways to look for these things, and people do look for them. This has been an exciting and controversial area in experiment. DAMA, which is an Italian experiment in the Gran Sasso laboratory, has been claiming for several years to see some evidence for a dark matter signal in their sodium iodide detector. And if so, if their signal is real, it implies that the dark matter particle has a mass around 60 GeV and a cross-section somewhere around 10 to the minus 5 to 10 to the minus 6 picobaryons. Now, it's controversial because several other experiments like CDMS and Edelweiss, and there's also a Zeppelin curve, although it hasn't been published, seem to rule out the favored DAMA parameter space. Now, what the Dhamma people say, and quite justifiably, is that in order to compare the sodium iodine experiment with limits from germanium or xenon, one has to assume some properties for the dark matter particle. And when we make this plot, we assume, make the simplest assumption, that the particle has some scalar interactions with ordinary matter. It turns out, though, that my collaborators and I, Pierre Ulio, Peter Vogel, Andrei Kurilov, and I, have looked at the possibility that the particle could have more general interactions that might evade. So if you assume that the Dhamma particle had a spin-dependent interaction with protons or neutrons, it could evade detection in some of these other experiments, but in that case it would have shown up in energetic neutrino searches from the sun. So the bottom line seems to be that the Dhamma signal cannot be accommodated with null searches from other experiments unless one really jumps through a number of unlikely hoops. So, there are also experiments that one can do to look for axions, and those experiments are being pursued. I won't talk about them any further. But basically, I think I've said what I want to say. This is more for me than for you. So dark matter exists. We've known this for 70 years. It's not going to go away, I hope. It's not going to go away. There a new stable weakly interacting massive particle, for example, the light supersymmetric particle, continues to provide a very intriguing candidate for dark matter. There are ways to detect it. There are many other possible dark matter candidates, quote, discussed in the literature, the most interesting of which may be the axion. I do not necessarily see that any of these other particles that are discussed in literature are as well motivated or as interesting from an experimental point of view as the weakly interacting massive particle. So, the second topic, negative pressure dark energy. We hear a lot about these days. This is a very, very strange mystery. It's nice to think about it in simple physical terms. We know that in gravity, I mean, you all know this, but it's kind of fun to go through anyway. We know that in gravity, if I throw this eraser up, it's going to come back down. Now, if I could throw really hard, the eraser would escape. If I threw the eraser with a velocity greater than the escape velocity, then it would continue to fly away from the Earth, but it would do so, it would always decelerate, right? The velocity with which it moves away from the Earth would always continue to decrease. However, what seems to be the case with the universe, which is a system of self-gravitating galaxies, this picture indicates that the opposite is true. In the universe, the galaxies seem to be moving apart with a velocity, relative velocity, that increases with time. And from this, we've inferred that there must be some negative pressure dark energy, which in some ways acts as a negative source for gravity. Huh, this is a problem. I can try turning the laptop. No. Well, I've chosen to plot the vacuum energy on the x-axis and the mass density on the y-axis. And this is a plot that I'm sure you've seen before. There's a more recent plot. Peter Garnovich has shown results at a meeting last week, although I couldn't find the updated plot. The error ellipse is now decreased. It now looks more like this. So they seem to be converging to the value that everybody believes to be the correct one. The ideas for this, the most widely studied is quintessence. So one postulates the existence of a scalar field. This is work by Caldwell and Steinhardt, and there were many others. One postulates the existence of a scalar field with some potential, and the scalar field slowly rolls down the potential, and so the cosmological constant is not quite so constant. The vacuum energy density acts as a time-varying cosmological constant. My collaborators and I tried to come up with an alternative in which one has a potential with the U1 symmetry, and instead the scalar field rolls around and slowly spirals to the minimum of the potential. It turns out that this is a difficult model to get to work, but it was a really fun paper to write. A lot of interesting physics. Another sideways plot. So. Actually, there's a way to straighten this with the PDF viewer, but I know if I touch any button, it's going to screw up and we'll be back where we were this morning. So, this is the expansion rate, or the distance modulus is a function of redshift. These blue points are data points that we have now. The red points are what we expect from the SNAP satellite. There's a lot of attention in amongst experimental particle physicists to actually fly the satellite, and it seems to be gaining momentum with the DOE and with NASA. And the air ellipse, which is now something like this with SNAP, would be very tiny, assuming that is the correct point in the mass density, vacuum energy density parameter space. The bottom line, though, is that dark energy, although it receives a lot of theoretical attention, poses a lot of questions, some of them good. So the first question one should ask, is it really there? And I should say that I was very, very skeptical. I remain skeptical. Remember that spectacular claims require spectacular spectacular exploration and verification. So it's natural to ask, if something as stunning as a cosmological constant seems to be suggested by the data, is the data really suggesting that? And it seems like it is. It's very hard to wiggle out of. There do not seem to be any systematic effects that could mimic a cosmological constant in the supernova data and in the CMB data and the large-scale structure data. So it seems like it might actually be there. If it is there, should it vary with time? And if so, why should it vary with time? The single scalar field models for quintessence all suggest the W, the equation of state parameter, is bigger than minus one, but some people, I think Robert Caldwell got the ball rolling a couple years ago with the phantom energy paper, suggest that maybe W might be less than minus one, and some of the data may suggest that W is less than minus one. Is it, instead of some dark energy, alternative gravity? So I think back in June or July, there was a paper by Sean, Mike Turner, and some others on a 1 over R gravity, and I think that every day thereafter there was a paper on 1 over R gravity, and then one on 1 over R squared gravity, and 1 over R to the 2.5 gravity, and connections with Kranz-Dickey and scalar field. I'm not sure what the current status is. Is it a rolling scalar field? Are there connections to dark matter or variable alpha? There have been nice papers on that. Are there connections to tests of the equivalence principle? Remember, in theoretical physics, we are supposed to look for economy in our explanations of physical phenomena. And if there are seemingly disparate phenomena like dark matter and dark energy and variable alpha and violations of the equivalence principle, a good theoretical model should explain not one, but maybe even two or more of them. So I particularly like the papers that have been trying to connect variable alpha with dark energy and also with equivalence principle tests. Nice paper by Dvalli and Zaldarjaga and several others. Another question that will almost certainly require new physics is inflation. So let me skip this. This figure here, which you've seen and is now out of date, although I didn't have time to download the most recent one. This is a measurement of the CMB power spectrum. This is now 2 years old. This is the boomerang measurement. There was also a simultaneous measurement by Daisy and Maxima. And now, of course, the error bars all along here are dramatically shrunk by WMAP. The point is that the CMB power spectrum exhibits very clear bumps and wiggles. And we've been focusing in most of our talks on how these bumps and wiggles determine cosmological parameters. But it must be understood that in order to determine cosmological parameters with the CMB, we must first realize that there's an underlying large-scale structure model that one assumes in order to fit these cosmological parameters. The good news is that the underlying cosmological model that we assume, which is primordial, nearly scale invariant, primordial adiabatic density perturbations from inflation, is now verified very nicely by these bumps and wiggles. If structure formation was due to topological defects or isocurvature perturbations or Steed models or explosion models or something else, the power spectrum would have looked completely different. So even without doing any Bayesian type of analysis, we can just look at the power spectrum and be very confident that structure did grow by a nearly scale invariant spectrum of primordial adiabatic density perturbations. So I think that is perhaps the most dramatic conclusion that we can make from the measurements. So the measurements do, and the other thing that we can conclude from the measurements is that the first peak occurs at roughly 1 degree, L of 200, which seems to suggest that the universe is very close to flat, also a prediction of inflation. So the flatness and the peak structure give us very, very strong reason to believe that we're on the right track with inflation. So I'm not a philosopher of scientist. I don't know. I'm not a philosopher of science. I don't know if this proves that inflation occurred. However, I do know that inflation had several opportunities at this point to fail. Okay, it did not need to be that the universe was flat, and it could have been that the CMB power spectrum looked completely different. So it seems that we're on the right track with inflation, and if so, it's natural to ask, what is the new physics responsible for inflation? So if I stay in 3+1 dimensions, then one can ask, what is the new physics responsible for inflation in a slightly different way? One can ask, what is the energy scale of inflation? So inflation may have plausibly occurred in 3+1 dimensional models and at energy scales as low as the electroweak symmetry breaking scale, or energy scales all the way at the quantum gravity scale, or the Planck scale. There are a number of models, a number of people who have forced to bet would bet on the gut phase transition at about 10 to the 16th GeV. It could have had something to do with Pecci-Quinn symmetry breaking, supersymmetry breaking. So one way to ask this question is, what is the energy scale of inflation? What was the temperature of the universe when inflation occurred or began to occur? So back in the early 1980s, maybe even late 1970s, a number of people pointed out that inflation predicts the existence of a stochastic gravitational wave background. And the calculations show that the amplitude of this gravitational wave background depends very robustly on the energy scale of inflation. It's a very, very difficult prediction to wiggle out of in 3+1 dimensional models. And so, if you can detect these gravitational waves, that would be a very nice signature of inflation. And moreover, if you could detect them, you would determine, of course, their amplitude, and that would tell you something about the energy scale of inflation. So a number of us pointed out several years ago that these gravitational waves can be detected through a unique polarization pattern that they induce in the cosmic microwave background, a so-called curl component in the CMB polarization. So if one can do a CMB polarization experiment with sufficient sensitivity and detect this this polarization component, then you would detect, you would have additional evidence not only for inflation, but for inflation at the gut scale. Now the question, though, is what is the energy scale of inflation? Again, sideways, not good. A question one can ask is, what is the energy scale of inflation? And although inflation is a very attractive paradigm, I don't think that there is one particular model that is so better motivated than the others that one can say with any confidence what the energy scale of inflation really is. But this is a plot that is supposed to show you, in some sense, the inflationary model parameter space. This is the spectral index for that primordial density perturbations running from 0.9 to 0.98. N is probably somewhere in this range, or almost certainly within this range. And then on this scale over here is the energy scale of inflation squared, which is proportional to the gravitational wave amplitude. So models over here have been ruled out already by Kobe. The fact that Kobe saw temperature fluctuations no more than 10 to the minus 5 tells us that the energy scale of inflation had to be less than about 3 times 10 to the 16th GeV quantity to the fourth. These are the currently viable inflationary models. The models that you find in the literature can be classified into various power law or exponential type potentials or spontaneous symmetry breaking potentials, and that's what these different curves and regions show. This is the sensitivity that should be achievable by the Planck satellite, which is going to be flown in 2007 or 2008 by the European Space Agency. So any model that lives up here, if it exists, will be detected by Planck. It turns out that one can actually improve on the sensitivity of Planck from the ground by doing an experiment that integrates in a smaller patch of the sky more deeply. And there are now three experiments, well actually two, that are really aimed at doing this. One is called BICEP and one is called QUIET. They're both now being pursued, and they should be able to get to these regions of parameter space here. And now NASA has in the roadmap and has sent out a call for proposals for mission concept studies for a post-Planck experiment called CMBPOL, for lack of a better term. And the aim of such a mission would be to get way down here. So about 5 to 6 orders of magnitude below the current Kobe upper limit in parameter space.
That's Order than magnitude in terms of the cosmological constant. So the fourth root of that for scale.
That's right. So this would get you all the way down to about 10 to the 15th GeV quantity to the fourth. Whereas we're now at 2 to 3 times 10 to the 16. So, just as a brief aside, there are other possibilities. There may be other things that we can learn about the physics of inflation from the cosmic microwave background. This is a somewhat speculative idea. I like talking about it, though, especially to superstring audiences. With the cosmic microwave background temperature and polarization, one can actually construct parity-violating observables. So one can actually look at a measured CMB temperature and polarization map and ask whether it's consistent with parity conservation or whether it's consistent with parity violation. And Arthur Liu, Lehman Wong, and I came up with two examples, not necessarily well-motivated, but, well, you can write down the terms. This is actually something that Sean Carroll thought about when he was thinking about rotation of polarization from distant radio sources. So if one has a scalar field that couples to the FU nu tilde for electromagnetism, that can produce such a parity-violating effect. If there is a gravitational analog of this term, where phi is the inflaton, couples to this combination of the Riemann tensor with an anti-symmetric tensor contracted, then one could also induce parity-violating signatures in the cosmic microwave background. Essentially, if you had such a term, you'd produce more gravitational waves of right circular polarization than left circular polarization, and that would be detectable in the polarization temperature map. Another probe of the gravitational wave background, at very low frequencies, the cosmic microwave background probes the gravitational wave background. At higher frequencies, shorter wavelengths, this is the most optimistic gravitational wave background from the point of view of these experiments that's consistent with the upper limit from COBE. You see that LISA is sort of just at the limit of getting the most optimistic model. It's not looking too good for LIGO. It turns out, though, that NASA also has in their roadmap something they call the Big Bang Observer, which is supposed to be even bigger in terms of bucks than the CMB pole experiment, although it's all quite futuristic at this point. And the primary aim of the Big Bang Observer is to detect gravitational wave backgrounds from inflation or other early universe processes. And the aim of such a mission would be to get several orders of magnitude below LISA in roughly this wave band over here. There's also this upper limit here. This is an interesting story. Pulsar timing can place constraints to the gravitational wave background for gravitational waves with roughly kiloparsec wavelengths. And this is the upper limit. If you talk to the people who do these measurements, they say that a moderate effort, say several million dollar type project, could improve this limit by roughly an order of magnitude or maybe even two. There's a nice paper by Don Backer and Andrew Jaffe recently. But for various reasons, the people who do pulsar timing, the radio astronomers who do pulsar timing, don't do big projects, especially to look for gravitational wave backgrounds. But apparently, I've been told that there is no technical reason why this could not be lowered by an order of magnitude or two with current technology and current telescopes. Yeah. So if you have a single field slow roll 3+1 dimensional inflation, the gravitational wave background has a spectral index n equals 0 at most, and if anything, it would be redder than this. You can get blue spectra in other models. Oh, this break here?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's a scale invariant spectrum. This break arises because modes that enter the horizon before while the universe is still radiation dominated grow differently than those that enter after matter domination. It's kind of neat. You can actually derive this analytically, which you can't do for density perturbations. Get the exact answer.
So this is the gut scale inflation.
Yeah. So this is a gut scale inflation. This is the largest gravitational wave background consistent with the upper limit from COBE. That's right. I should have said that. A null result from any of these experiments does not rule out inflation by any means. So there are other ways that one can probe the physics responsible for inflation. So inflation postulates an inflaton field, which I showed a cartoon of. And in order for slow roll inflation to be sufficiently slow roll to actually inflate, it requires that the scalar field be at most very weakly self-coupled during inflation. And as a consequence of that, it means that the primordial distribution of density perturbations is Gaussian, or very close to Gaussian. But it turns out that there will be, generically, some tiny self-coupling of the inflaton potential, and that will lead to some tiny deviations from Gaussianity. So, if one measures the fractional density perturbation delta as a function of position in the universe, and then plots its distribution, normalized divided by the variance, inflation predicts that it should be Gaussian. Departures from Gaussianity will look something like this. And actually, the predictions of Gaussianity are more general and powerful than just this one-point distribution. So there are a number of ways that one can check whether the primordial distribution of density perturbations was Gaussian. So first of all, one can do so with the cosmic microwave background. So let me go back. I think that the local theoretical physicist, Mark Srednicki, was one of the first people to calculate the non-Gaussianity. There was also a paper by Grinstein and Wise. And then there's been recent work by Maldacena that's gotten a lot of attention. So there are a number of ways that one can check to see whether the primordial perturbations were Gaussian. One can actually look at the cosmic microwave background, which presumably probes the primordial distribution of mass directly. And you can see whether the temperature fluctuations have a Gaussian distribution. One can also look at the distribution of galaxies in the universe today, or the distribution of mass in the universe today with cosmic shear or weak gravitational lensing surveys. It's a little more difficult to compare the results of such measurements with theoretical predictions, because theory predicts that if the primordial distribution of perturbations was Gaussian, when those perturbations are amplified by gravitational infall, they become non-Gaussian. So one will find that the distribution of galaxies is non-Gaussian, and then one has to try to infer from that by essentially running Newton's equations back in time whether the initial conditions that gave rise to that non-Gaussian distribution were Gaussian. But still, it can be done to some extent. One can also measure the abundance of galaxy clusters or rare high redshift galaxies. These are objects which presumably form at the 3-sigma tail of the 3-sigma high-density tail of the primordial density distribution. So if you had some non-Gaussian distribution, such as that shown by this dashed line, that produced more 3-sigma peaks, then you'd expect to see more galaxy clusters or more high-redshift galaxies. And that is another way that one can look for non-Gaussianity. And then there are also the properties of clusters that one can use. Let me see if I have the bottom line, though. No bottom line. The bottom line, though, is that all of these methods are somewhat complementary depending on the degree of faith you're willing to put into the astrophysics. This certainly gives you the most systematically understood prediction. But you'll find different people in the literature claiming that you can do better with different ones of these different such measurements. And different measurements are viewed in these papers. Now, there is another possible way that we might be able to study inflation, or maybe there might be, let me put it another way, there might be yet further evidence for deviations from the standard cosmological model that require new physics beyond the standard model. So it turns out, this is a simulation of a galaxy cluster. That's not relevant for this. This is a simulation of a galactic halo. So this is an N-body gravitational simulation just of the dark matter halo with no baryons. And this is roughly 300 kiloparsecs across. The Milky Way is a galaxy that looks something like this, but it should have a galactic halo that is roughly this size. And what this numerical simulation shows you is that the galactic halo has tons of little subhalos in it. So the Milky Way, which is presumably housed in this dark matter halo in the center over here, should be surrounded by hundreds of satellite dwarf galaxies, according to this numerical simulation. So this is a plot of the predicted number of galactic satellites, or Milky Way satellites, and then this is a plot of the number observed. So the numerical simulation predicts several hundred dwarf satellites, whereas what are observed are roughly 10 or 11. So this is perhaps a problem for cold dark matter models with scale invariant primordial perturbations. Now, there are a number of possible explanations. Some of them involve conventional astrophysics. So, for example, the dark matter halos might be there, but the gas might have been blown out by supernovae. A number of people have explored this. This is a possibility, but it's hard to get it to work from the astrophysics point of view. You can get it to work, but it's not trivial. It's not something that people really thought about before the fact. After the fact, you can sort of get it to work, but it's a little difficult. Other possible resolutions are self-interacting dark matter. This was a very interesting idea I mentioned before, proposed by Spergel and Steinhardt. So very impressively enough from the astrophysics point of view, it now looks that the original proposal is ruled out. If one postulates a dark matter particle that scatters from itself with a cross-section that is a power law of velocity, then the dark matter cross-section required to explain this galactic substructure and other problems of galactic substructure have been ruled out by observations and measurements of the distribution of dark matter in galaxy clusters and in giant elliptical galaxies. There are other possibilities like very low mass scalars. There could also be power suppression on small scales from hot dark matter or warm dark matter. Another possibility is that it might be indicating a break in the inflaton potential. So inflation postulates an inflaton phi with some potential, V of phi, and it turns out that roughly speaking, the density perturbation amplitude on any scale is proportional to V to the 3 halves divided by V prime, not double prime. Is that a real double prime or is that a, it's not even clear. It's a V prime. So anyway, if there is a bump, if there's a break in the power spectrum, V prime will change suddenly and power will be suppressed on smaller scales. So if you have such a break in the inflaton potential, then the primordial power spectrum, which with scale invariant primordial perturbations looks like this, would be changed to something look like one of these two curves here. So power on scales smaller than a megaparsec or a few megaparsecs could be dramatically suppressed if you have such a broken scale invariant inflationary potential. And with such a suppressed power spectrum, you can, in fact, account for the small number of satellites that are observed. So that's another possibility. Let me skip pretty pictures. So two other possibilities, self-interacting dark matter. Several people, Zhule Chen, who's here, and collaborators, and Celine Bohm and collaborators, have studied the possibility that there could be weak interactions between baryons and dark matter in the early universe. And if so, those interactions would keep dark matter particles in kinetic equilibrium well after they froze out. And in this way, you would suppress small-scale power. It turns out that this cannot work with a neutralino, so it would require that the dark matter be something other than the standard weakly interacting massive particles that people have thought about. Another possibility is decaying particles. Chris Sigerson is a very hard-working graduate student at Caltech, who's finishing the paper as I'm here giving the talk. So the last thing I want to briefly mention is the dearth of large angle CMB correlations. So one of the surprising results from MAP, which was actually a confirmation of the same result or a similar result from COBE, is that the CMB quadrupole moment seems to be low. And whether it's actually really low or just a statistical fluke, people still argue about. So the question is this a statistical fluke or is it a sign of new superhorizon physics? Is there some type of break in the power spectrum on scales larger than the horizon? Or is there something else going on? Is there a curvature scale just beyond the observable horizon? So this is a frustrating question because the cosmic microwave background quadrupole moment measurement is limited not by statistics or by experiment, but it's limited by cosmic variance. The fact that we're trying to measure the variance of a Gaussian distribution with no more than 5 data points. And we're not going to get any more than 5 data points because there are only 5 quadrupole moments for the CMB sky. So the question is, can one, well, here's actually the plot. So this is 2 sigma. So it's off by 2 sigma, depending on how you what you call 2 sigma. Let's not get into that. So the question is there any other measurement that one can make to check whether the low power in the quadrupole is statistically significant or not? So without going into details, when we look at the CMB, we are looking at the surface of last scatter. So we're looking at a two-dimensional spherical surface through our three-dimensional volume of the universe. With weak gravitational lensing of the cosmic microwave background, one can actually measure a distribution of mass between us and the surface of last scatter, and in some sense measure the distribution of mass at the distribution of primordial mass not only at the surface of last scatter, but throughout the three-dimensional volume of our universe. So without going into details, what Mike Kesden, Asantha Akure, and I did was calculated the cross-correlation coefficient between the cosmic microwave background temperature and the weak lensing of the cosmic microwave background, which is a measure of the projected gravitational potential along the line of sight. So if R, this cross-correlation coefficient is 1, that means that the CMB temperature and the projected potential are perfectly correlated. If it's 0, that means they have nothing to do with each other. And this quantity is statistically independent of the CMB temperature quadrupole moment that has been measured already. So if we can measure this, this adds more information to that which we have from the CMB surface of last scatter already. So if there is no break in the power spectrum, the correlation coefficient turns out to be something like 0.2. And if there is a break in the CMB power spectrum that is producing the low quadrupole moment, then in that case, it turns out that the cross-correlation coefficient is close to 0.8. So the cross-correlation coefficient gets boosted by roughly a factor of 4 if the CMB quadrupole moment is low because there is power suppressed on scales larger than the horizon. So the question now is, 4 seems like a big number, but do we have enough statistical significance? Are there going to be enough independent multiple moments to actually measure a distribution whose variance is this and distinguish it from a distribution whose variance is that? So we have a number of multiple moments. We've got a quadrupole, let's see, 2. A quadrupole, L equals 3, L equals 4, and L equals 5, and by L equals 6, the two predictions are indistinguishable. So the quadrupole moment has 5 data points, the L equals 3 has 7, L equals 4 has 9, L equals 5 has 11. So in all, it's like 25 data points that we have to try to distinguish this distribution from that distribution. And the answer is, let's see, this is the distribution for cross-correlation coefficients that one would measure if there was a strong cross-correlation, and this is the distribution of cross-correlation coefficients that one would measure if there was no cross-correlation, or the weak cross-correlation that you would get from no cutoff. So the question is, can we distinguish this distribution from this distribution with 25 data points, roughly speaking? And it turns out that with Monte Carlo calculations, we verify that these two distributions can be distinguished at roughly 3 sigma with a full-sky cosmic microwave background temperature and projected potential, which require weak lensing map of the sky, which is something that an experiment like CMB pole could in principle do. So if we get 3 sigma and add it to the 2 sigma from the CMB that we have so far, you're not allowed to add sigmas, but more or less 3 plus 2 is still bigger than 3. And so maybe it's something that we might be able to say in the few years that we actually know that there's power or dearth of power on large scales, we know that it's just a statistical fluctuation rather than the current level of uncertainty that we have now. So, in summary, there are a number of interesting things going on in cosmology. Dark matter question, dark energy inflation, I think, will all require new fundamental physics. There are other questions, galactic substructure, dearth of large-angle CMB power, maybe ultra-high energy cosmic rays, maybe variable alpha running of the spectral index. These are things that people have discussed and suggested may require new physics, but it's not yet clear. These all may be statistical flukes. Some of them may be statistical flukes, or they might just be systematics in the current measurements. but these are certainly other possibilities. The good news is that in some cases there are clear avenues that one can pursue in terms of experiment. So for example, there are dark matter detection experiments with dark energy. We can measure the expansion rate as a function of redshift. In other cases, it's not so clear what it is that you would do further to figure out whether this was really new physics or not. Okay, thanks.
Questions for Mark?
Yeah. I'd heard that there were some lensing surveys that suggested that there are, in fact, a lot of dark dwarf galaxies. Is that wrong? You seem to dismiss that possibility.
There are people who have done measurements. There are certain anomalies in some of the strong lenses. When you have a lens, a strong lens, say with four images, the lensing model should predict consistently the positions as well as the magnifications. And also if you have timing, it should also predict that. There's some anomalies with the brightnesses of some of the lenses. And some people have postulated that's due to lensing, due to substructure. But I don't think that those are conclusive. There are other possible explanations that people talk about. And even if it is a dwarf galaxy, it's not enough statistics to really tell whether it's the number you expect or the number you don't. But it is an interesting measurement.
It has to be consistent. It has to have more dark matter than the substructure. It has to have more, to be consistent with the observations, it has to have so much dark matter than the substructure, it wouldn't have enough before. It has to be
inconsistent.
Okay. Hi, Mark. Since you mentioned non-Gaussianity, did you notice this paper, I think it was last week, by a Spanish group claiming that they have a positive detection of non-Gaussian features in the CMB?
No, I missed that one. Okay. I was so busy preparing this talk last week.
Okay.
And trying to get the technology working that I didn't see. But they wouldn't be the first ones. People detected non-Gaussianity in COBE, it then disappeared. It went away. They detected non-Gaussianity, and some people have detected non-Gaussianity sort of in MAP. That's probably not there. There's no overt detection of non-Gaussianity anywhere that I believe so far, but I haven't seen this paper.
Mark, a few years ago, I remembered that Ostreicher was here, and he was claiming that somehow the size of the black holes, the mass of the black holes in the galactic centers, studying different galaxies, somehow there was very strong evidence for self-interacting dark matter. Has that data gone away, or another explanation?
I never believed that. I didn't understand it.
You were saying that things tend to fall.
Yeah, I didn't understand it because we can explain the masses of supermassive black holes with ordinary baryons, ordinary matter falling, accreting onto black holes. There's a consistency between the luminosity density of the universe that comes from AGN and the amount of matter required to fall into black holes, the amount of baryonic matter required to fall into black holes to produce the supermassive black holes we see in galaxies. So it doesn't seem to me that we need new physics to understand black hole masses.
Well, I had a comment, a question. You made a statement that was, I thought, a little stronger than you meant, which is that if neutralinos exist, they must be the dark matter. One does not imply the other. They could be a subcomponent of the dark matter the same way neutrinos are. And I mention that because that means if you observe WIMPs in underground experiments, that's not sufficient to say they're the dark matter. You have to go back and measure their annihilation cross-section. So I know you know that, but I was just saying that for the benefit of others. But I wanted to ask you, you said that the cluster data, for example, which is on a larger scale, is inconsistent with self-interacting dark matter. But there is this interesting study out of Caltech, the Caltech group, Richard Ellis et al., which is the biggest survey of clusters I know of, which shows systematic inconsistency with the cold collisionless picture and seems to suggest a smoother core. Now that's interesting because that the only way you can do that and at the same time make any dwarf galaxies, among all the things you suggested, is something like self-interacting dark matter. So do you have some reason for discounting those measurements?
Oh, the thing about self-interacting dark matter is that if it exists, if there's only one type of dark matter, and that dark matter self-interacting, then you would expect there to see no dense cores. Okay?
That's not clear.
So the existence of a soft core does not prove that there's a strongly interacting dark matter, but if you can show conclusively there's a very dense core, then that rules out self-interacting dark matter, at least over the region of parameter space at which that cross-section would apply.
Well, I think so I'm thinking about that, but I want to know what you thought about the Ellis et al. Measurements, which suggest a soft core.
I don't think that, I think that's astrophysics rather than dark matter.
But the fact that it's in the cluster scale, I mean, it's very hard to think. So astrophysics in the galactic scale, and the substructure scale, that's plausible. But on the cluster scale, now you're talking about length scales, which are much harder. I mean, I don't know.
No. People have, there's a paper by Amar L. Zant and his collaborators. I don't remember who were on this particular paper. But there are people who claim that that you could easily have baryons collecting at the center and displacing the dark matter.
What?
Yeah. So this is something that, this is one of those things where it's dirty astrophysics, but it's conceivable that can be done, and people have sort of written a plausibility argument paper, but haven't really done, it's hard to actually prove conclusively that you could do that. But what No, the thing about strongly interacting, the two observations that I'm referring to with strongly interacting dark matter are the Meralda Escudé and other people who talked about non-spherical cores that you get from non-radial strong lenses. And then there's also a measurement by Lowenstein and Mushatsky of a giant elliptical galaxy where they have gas in hydrostatic equilibrium, and they can measure from that a density profile to very small radii, and suggests this giant elliptical has a very dense core at very small radii, and that's inconsistent with the strongly interacting dark matter.
I just wanted to, I guess it's as much an observation as a question, and one of the things that impressed me most about the WMAP data was the cross-correlation they saw between the temperature and polarization. And that seems to strongly suggest that that the perturbations were super horizon, or there were super horizon perturbations at recombination. So I was just wondering if you could comment on how that observation, which is the same data that you'd use to test this idea that there's Planck scale CP parity violation going on, and also detectable in the CMB, whether that, to what extent the measurement of the super horizon perturbation signal from the TE correlation is consistent, or could be contaminated by this other signal?
Well, I don't understand your statement that the TE cross-correlation suggests super horizon in physics. What people have suggested is that, people have said that the existence of density perturbations on scales larger than a degree is an indication of super horizon physics. And that was an argument that you could make even with COBE. So I'm not sure what the TE cross-correlation adds. The large angle TE cross correlation, we actually believe is due to sub horizon physics. It's quite likely, if not certain, that's due to the effects of reionization, which take place at redshifts of 10 to 20 or so.
I guess my point was more that if you had cosmic strings or some other mechanism for producing the underlying perturbations, then you'd have a different prediction for the cross-correlation from what you have.
Yes, that's true. And there were some people who did point out, and I think the MAP team did point out, that there are models that one could construct, very doctored models that one could construct, in which you would get a CMB temperature power spectrum that looked like the one that was observed, but had that was produced by some type of topological defect model. It was very doctored. And it turns out,
closed universe.
No, 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 not the low quadrupole. Just the TE cross correlation, not the smaller scales. And one of the things that the measurement of the TE cross correlation did, not the large angle, the small angle TE cross correlation did, is rule out those models. So the measurement of the TE cross correlation, not the large angle stuff that everybody pays all attention to, but the small angle measurement, is a very, very nice additional confirmation of primordial adiabatic perturbations.
Okay, time for one more.
Okay.
already can speak? Okay, fine. So it's a simple comment, especially probably for string theorists. When experimentalists talk about the scale of inflation, the scale, energy scale of inflation they're talking about, it is what happened during the last 60 folds of inflation. And when theorists are talking about the same subject, they are interested also in what happened before the 60 foldings, because usually inflation lasts much longer. And usually the best models of inflation from the point of view of solving basic cosmological problems are those that start inflation as close to the Planck density or string density, whichever comes lowest. So this would be a much larger scale.
I agree. Thank you.
Well, let's thank all of our morning speakers again for some excellent talks.